here we are in session two, Toward a Cultural History of Captivity, Race, Agency, and the Republic of Letters. Our first speaker is Bao Bui, who is an assistant professor of history at Stephen Austin State University. He recently completed his dissertation entitled, I Feel Compelled to Write. Okay. He has a wonderful title. I Feel Compelled to Write, Male Intimacy, Epistolary Privacy, and the Culture of Letter Writing During the Civil War. And he finished his degree at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He is also the author of a really great essay, An Englishman in a Kentucky Regiment, The Civil War Letters of Robert Wynne, in a really great journal, Ohio Valley History. And we have two issues of the journal, and this one has a lot. Of course, it has Bao's essay, but it has several other essays having to do with the Civil War. So we encourage you to all get a copy of Bao's essay in particular in our journal. So his paper today is entitled Information Access, Agency, and Autonomy for Prisoners of War During the Civil War. Our second presenter is Brian Feltman, who is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Georgia Southern University. His book, The Stigma of Surrender, German Prisoners, British Captors, and Manhood in the Great War and Beyond, was published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2015. And today, his paper is entitled American Exceptionalism, The Experience of Doughboy Prisoners of the First World War. And at the end, we have Adam S. Rock, who is a doctoral student the History Department at Southern Mississippi. His dissertation considers the role of race in the treatment of prisoners of war. And his paper today is entitled, Would They Be Worth the Effort? The Influence of Race on American Re-education Programs for German and Japanese POWs in the U.S. during World War II. So, gentlemen.
Thank you, Leanne, for those wonderful comments. I also want to thank Leanne for getting my first publication out, so I can say that my first publication ever as a scholar was with the Ohio Valley History Journal. But also, I would like to thank the Filson Historical Society for funding a very considerable portion of my research here during the last 5 years when I was working on my dissertation. So a portion today of the research I've been able to present to you also came directly from my time spent here at the Filson Historical Society. So let's begin. When war broke out between the northern and southern states in April 1861, both sides anticipated a short, decisive, and victorious conflict. Abraham Lincoln, at the onset, believed a hastily raised national army of 75,000 volunteers would be sufficient to crush the rebellion in 3 months' time. What began as a 90-day campaign turned into a 4-year war of bloody attrition. By the end of the war, almost 3 million Americans had served in uniform, roughly about 10% of the entire population in 1860. One early 20th century estimate counted 193,743 Northerners and 214,865 Southerners who were captured and confined during the course of the conflict. So roughly about 400,000 POWs altogether. Put another way, one in every 7 Civil War soldier would be a prisoner of war at some point in their term of service. In the regimental camps, garrisons, and even on ships, soldiers complained of boredom, lack of privacy, isolation, and onerous regulations. Prison accentuated these features of military life. Prisoners of war wrote unsparingly of their misery. Some had a knack for understatement. One Pennsylvanian, S.J. Gibson, languishing away at the notorious Confederate prison in Andersonville, Georgia, wrote to his wife, "It is my misfortune still to be held a prisoner of war. our condition is by no means a desirable one. And I love that sort of nice English understatement to his, you know, he's in Andersonville. You know about Andersonville, right? It's not a desirable place to be. A rebel known only as Harry and held at Johnson's Island in Ohio described prison life as more like a dog's life than anything else. Shortly after the war ended, an Ohioan who had survived his own POW stay in the South wrote of what he called those miserable, irksome, and disgusting prisons, where he and his fellow bluecoats, in quotes, passed the days in inhuman and indescribable suffering, unquote. A survivor of Andersonville, James Hudson of the 5th Indiana Cavalry, reflected some three decades after his ordeal, "God spared me to live through all the horrors of that prison." According to Hudson, more Union soldiers lost their lives by the Southern prisons than were killed in the 2,161 battles of the Rebellion. I don't know how he counted it, but there you have it. The Hoosiers' claim has a ring of truth to it. 4 times more Union soldiers died at Andersonville, about 13,000, than at Gettysburg, where the total fatality was roughly about 4,000 or 5,000 towards the end. One report estimated that over 30,000 Union and nearly 26,000 Confederate prisoners died in captivity. Whether in the regimental camps or in the prison pens, soldiers rejoiced at the arrival of the mail. George W. Winchester wrote from Johnson's Island to his sister Almira, "Your letter afforded me great pleasure. The correspondence of the prisoner is one of his chief sources of relief from the horrible ennui of this monotonous life," unquote. Another rebel soldier echoed the same sentiments to his own sister. "I must express my approval of your determination to write to me weekly. For were it not for letters, I cannot imagine how I could endure prison life. As it is, they afford me the greatest relief," unquote. And here is actually, I was actually able to find a photo of this soldier right here, John Ellis, Captain John Ellis. And here he is, you know, telling his, I believe it's his sister, again his sister, how refreshing it is and how rejuvenating it is to get a letter from her. And notice the beautiful poetry. These soldiers had a wonderful knack for writing in terms of metaphor and simile, the likes of which we could only envy today. Yes, these kinds of throwaway cultural references, people actually understood it back in those days, and you just sort of tossed them out freely in your literature, knowing that the person in the receiving end would know who Napoleon was or who Maximilian was. Mid-19th century America produced the most literate and socially connected armies ever known until then. In the regiments of the North, literacy rates were above 90%, near 100% in the regiments of New England. The South lagged behind the North in terms of providing public education. Still, some 80% of all Confederate troops possessed a functional level of reading and writing proficiency. So we're looking at illiteracy rates of well below 20% in the South and below 10% in the North. Within the modern era, Civil War soldiers compare quite favorably with those of the European counterparts. As late as World War I, the illiteracy rates of recruits stood at 33% in Italy and 22% in Austria-Hungary. So to give you a comparison, in 1860, the South had an illiteracy rate half as that of what Italy had 50 years later during the First World War, which tells us the sheer level of literacy in American life in mid-19th century America. What's more, the Americans who marched off to war in 1861 benefited from the decades-long maturation of the American national postal system. In the regimental camps, many Americans, including ex-slaves, became active users of the postal mail for the first time in their lives. In the American South before 1860, it was forbidden by law to teach a slave how to read. Even free blacks were forbidden from working as mail carriers out of fear that such blacks could be used to organize slave revolts. That the average soldier could maintain regular contact with his or her home community via the post mail was revolutionary, for that landmark feature of the Civil War changed how both civilians and combatants understood and recorded the meanings and significance of their wartime experiences. The daily time spent letter writing, the urgency with which postal delivery systems were set up in the camp communities, and the eagerness with which the mail was received suggests a strong emotional value that Americans attached to written correspondence. As one Union soldier told his mother, it is the event of the day to watch mail distribution. So to put this in perspective, consider that the history of literacy is roughly about 5,000 years, which you can more or less say is the beginnings of recorded military history as well. In that time, for the last 5,000 years, 99.9999% of all soldiers were illiterate. 99.999% of all soldiers went to their deaths, whether in battle or at home, without ever a single piece of recording of their abstract thinking. During the Civil War, you actually had the first time in human history where most soldiers, well above 80%, could read and write, that's one, and two, they had access to an affordable nationwide postal delivery system, which means they can actually record their abstract thinking and share those thoughts hundreds and thousands of miles away. To put this in perspective, when a soldier disappeared beyond the horizon in the Civil War, he could more or less expect to stay in touch with his family throughout the duration of the conflict. In the time of Peter the Great, this is 18th century Russia, it was said that when the recruiters came by to a village and took the peasant away from the village to become a soldier in armies of Peter the Great, his village would hold a funeral service for him, because as soon as he disappeared beyond horizon, he would disappear from their lives forever. He couldn't write to them. There was no mail by which he could actually send it. And of course, the villagers themselves were illiterate. Who would read the letter? Hence, in those days, when a recruit left beyond the boundaries of the village, he basically disappeared forever from the life of that community. Whereas during the Civil War, for the first time in human history, a soldier could be gone for years, thousands of miles away, and yet still maintain a regular correspondence with his family, giving his wife, his children, his family, his neighbors details of how his life is going on, and also instructions on how to raise the children, how much to sell the pig for, how much hay and how much crop has been harvested. So even though he was absent, he could still more or less, over the course of years, communicate his presence within his original home community. In the least, these wartime letters provided insight into the ideologies and cultural expectations that shaped these Americans' beliefs on manhood, patriotic duty, freedom, and the war itself. One turn-of-the-century study calculated that the armies of the North wrote or received 180,000 letters a day on average. One Yankee with a penchant for meticulous record-keeping, and I saw his record-keeping, he actually kept it sort of like an Excel spreadsheet of every single letter he wrote, reported that he wrote 163 letters in 1863, 109 of which were to his home folk, and 55 to other friends. He had a lot of friends. He composed an additional 37 letters for presumably illiterate comrades. In return, he received 85 letters in 1 year. Who gets that many letters even nowadays? Considering that the annual postal letter output in 1860 amounted to about 5 letters per person per year, this singular soldier had an epistolary output 40 times the national average, 40 times. Though few soldiers could rack up such impressive numbers, many, if not most, individual soldiers composed letters at a rate far above their peacetime levels. Plus, soldiers not only wrote prodigiously, they could also write candidly on any topic they pleased. Neither Union nor Confederate Army imposed a rigorous system of military oversight that censored or screened the contents of their own soldiers' writings while within the camps, the regimental camps. Letter writing provided one of the chief forms of daily leisure and helped soldiers sustain their morale. Soldiers' letters contain abundant testimonials to the benefits they derived from employing what a South Carolinian volunteer called this mighty weapon, the pen. Even from within the confines of the prison pen, the soldiers' writings flowed. The town postmaster of Sandusky, Ohio, reported he handled several hundred letters a day written by the Confederate inmates of nearby Johnson's Island, which is the Union POW camp. James W. Anderson of the 6th Tennessee managed to write regularly to his family during his 9-month stint as a POW. In one letter he wrote to his wife, "I have written you a great many letters and sent them in all directions that I could conceive to reach you." Remember, he's doing all this from prison. The letters of a Virginian lieutenant, Thomas A. Hatcher, suggest that even after his capture and his imprisonment, he still maintained regular contact with relatives in both northern and southern states. "I will write," he scribbled to his cousin in St. Louis, "whenever I have letter from the South, as heretofore, to let uncle know," his uncle in St. Louis, "whatever I hear of our relatives, I shall take pleasure in remembering you to all our Virginia friends and shall always be glad to hear often from you so that I can let them know how you are." It's a long run-on sentence, but that's how they wrote. Basically, what he's saying is that here he is, a lieutenant from Virginia in a POW camp somewhere in the north. He's corresponding with his cousins and uncle in St. Louis and also receiving letters from his family back home in Virginia. And he's acting as a conduit for transferring information back and forth between the two sides of his family, one in Union, Missouri, and the other one in Confederate Virginia. It's pretty crazy to think that here he is in prison, and he's still more or less, shall we say, in modern times, updating his newsfeed and Facebook profile. He's still acting as a conduit for his family scattered across 1,000 miles to transmit information back about familial affairs, even while he's still in prison. It's incredible. Hence, even as a POW caught in the act of armed rebellion against the national government, Hatcher successfully retained his status as an active participant in far-flung networks of familial epistolary exchanges. As in the regimental camp, so too in prison, soldiers had access to epistolary supplies in addition to sundry items like soap and clothing. Rebel prisoners at Johnson's Island even had access to a sutler, which basically is like a roving 7-Eleven or like a convenience store, basically, and what one soldier called his daily supply of vegetables. Yes, soldiers could buy vegetables from the local sutler while in prison, which, as the soldier complained, was available only to those who were able to pay for them. It speaks volume about the importance of letter writing. The letters between prisoners and the civilian correspondents repeatedly mentioned epistolary supplies in addition to other sought-after consumer goods like combs, handkerchiefs, shoes, and clothing. Sergeant Edwin O'Conklin of the 1st Michigan was taken prisoner at the Battle of the Crater in early July 1864. In a series of letters written over the next 3 months, Conklin mentioned his difficulty in acquiring writing supplies no less than 3 times. In one letter of the 19th of September, he looked to his mother for a solution, and he wrote to her, "Please send me some paper and envelopes." His application ultimately proved moot, for the sergeant's letter writing days ended with his death in prison on the 30th of November. So captured in early July, spent the next 3 months writing to his mother, asking her repeatedly, "Send me stamps, writing papers, envelopes." Then he died at the end of November while still a POW. Even if a soldier did not have a stamp, other means and opportunities existed to transmit a letter into the soldier's social network. One Confederate told his Union civilian correspondent, quote, "This letter will come to you through the hands of a friend leaving on exchange, and he promised to mail this." In other words, this POW is in prison. His buddy's about to get paroled. As his buddy's leaving the prison, he gives his buddy a letter saying that as soon as you're out of the prison camp and you get to a post office, drop this letter off for my family. The traffic in prison mail went in both directions. Civilians sent letters to prisoners who were family members or friends. The volume of mail for prisoners could be quite large. A Union POW held at Danville Prison in Virginia wrote in his diary in November 1864, "The officers of the day said that 10,000 letters arrived here for us prisoners. Oh, how the boys' hearts must have beat when they heard this." So think about this. I mean, you have to take it with a grain of salt, right? But even at 10,000 letters, it's kind of high, but still, it speaks to the sheer volume of mail coming into these Union prisons for the Confederate prisoners. Indeed, at one Union prison, the Confederate inmates complained bitterly when the incoming mail was delayed. A civilian, W.C. Miller, wrote to the military authorities in charge of Point Lookout Prison Camp near Baltimore regarding the welfare of Miller's brother, a rebel prisoner held there. In the postscript, Miller wrote, "Is correspondence with the prisoner prohibited?" The answer was yes, but not without strict rules. Not surprisingly, the prison, both North and South, saw the only real systematic effort by the military authorities to censure or regulate the soldiers' mail traffic. And to tell you how much absence there was of regulation in the regimental camps, I've actually come across letters written by both privates, enlisted men, but also by senior officers giving detailed information of upcoming battle plans. There was one Union colonel who wrote home to his wife, and he was just doing a free flow writing where he just everything off the top of his head. And as he was telling his wife how he felt about how life was back in the camp and how the kids were, he sort of meandered off and said, "Tomorrow we attack at dawn with 15,000 men from the north. Please don't tell anybody I said this." So he basically gave away the entire battle plan to his wife in detail, the number of men, the direction, what units were involved. And then he said, "Oops, I probably shouldn't have told you that, but don't tell anyone, okay?" And he mailed it too. And of course, we have the letter to prove that he did this. And he's a colonel in the Union Army. Can you imagine something like that happening today? J.W. Anderson, while held at Camp Chase in Ohio, informed his wife of the typical regulations imposed on POW's epistolary habits. Quote, "We are now restricted to one page like this, and hereafter it is all you need write in one letter as it might be torn, but they were kind enough yesterday to send in all your letter for which I am under many obligations to the officers in charge." So basically one letter in and out. Yet as this one Confederate letter indicates, while official regulations were in place, they varied depending on location and time. Plus, officers on site often had leeway in how to interpret and apply the rules. For example, Johnson's Island, a Union prison, initially allowed its inmate to send as many letters as they please. After September 1864, the policy changed to only two letters per week and only on Mondays and Thursdays. Letters written or received by prisoners were limited in length to one page or 28 lines. Excessively long letters meant imprisoned soldiers had their contents detained by the camp commandant. The intended recipient only received the empty envelope, which no doubt added to the agony of the prisoner's life. So imagine being separated from your family for years. You're now a POW in prison. Your family knows where you are. They've written you a letter to check up on you, to see how you're doing, to tell about what's happening at home. They wrote the letter too long. The camp commandant will open up the letter, seize the letter itself, and then give you the envelope just to rub in the agony. Even letters of acceptable length had their contents examined by the jailers. Letters with information deemed contraband were intercepted. A poignant civilian response to such restrictions on epistolary communications can be found in one letter by Miss George Arthur Williams to Captain J.N. Patterson of Point Lookout Prison Camp regarding her imprisoned husband, who obviously is named George Arthur Williams. And this is what she wrote. "You may always feel sure I will never abuse your kindness by writing any contraband news, but we ladies always have more to say than can be comfortably written on a single page. And when we are once started, it is very difficult to always abide by fixed rules and strict regulations." So this is the wife of a Confederate POW telling the commandant of a Union camp, you know, "I'm his wife. And of course, as a woman, once when I start writing something, I just keep on writing. And, you know, I can't stop. These rules and regulations, they just don't work for me." And I thought, you write a whole volume about the gender dynamics of that one single letter. Similar fixed rules and strict regulations apply at other Union prisons. One Confederate locked up in an Illinois pen claimed to his epistolary confidant, "The authorities read the letters directed to the prisoners of war." Hence, you have no privacy when you're in prison camp. At Camp Randall in Wisconsin, for example, the authorities censured outgoing mail from Confederates who complained about the harsh conditions or mentioned the high death rates in the camp. On Johnson's Island, the imprisoned Confederates responded accordingly to the measures imposed by the Union captors. One rebel imprisoned there wrote his niece, "Your envelope is at hand. Letter destroyed. Being examined by the authorities and pronounced contraband. You must be guarded in the future. You must have touched in a tender place." That is, she wrote something that must have been very sensitive information. So the camp commandant, Bornless, took the letter, destroyed it, gave him the envelope. Likewise, Aaron Blythe, a Kentucky cavalryman, informed his family from his prison in Camp Morton near Indianapolis. So this is a Kentucky who served in the Confederate forces. Write me all of the news, but you must not write anything about the war, just family news. Union POWs also complained when denied access to the mail. As one Union survivor of Libby prison in Richmond put it, we are seldom permitted to correspond with our friends in den, only under the most cruel restrictions. Our letters are limited to six lines of ordinary notepaper, including date, signature, and address. So you have six lines, got to put everything in, right? One Union soldier describing a failed attempt by one of his colleagues to bypass the censures noted, since then, our correspondence has been carefully scrutinized and will doubtless in the future be subjected to all manners of tests. Defiance and resistance characterize prison life right down to the epistolary traffic. One history of Johnson's Island described how the rebel prisoners devised an ingenious scheme to receive mail from Confederates in Canada using women or African Americans to carry the illicit mail across the Detroit River that separated the two countries. That's how far they were willing to go to get the mail. Such ingenuity did not limit itself to one side. As one Union veteran put it, every scheme that could be divined to outwit the rebels has been resorted to and successful to some extent. Many prisoners have learned the secret of writing with invisible ink, unquote. One Confederate prisoner informed his correspondent on several methods to bypass the prison censors. This is what he wrote to his cousin. Now, cousin, and remember, he's writing this from prison. Now, cousin, any communications you want to send in to this prison, you can do so by putting the communication in the sole, that is S-O-L-E, of a shoe fold's sole, on the inside on the lining of pants at the bottom, or in the lining of a hat, and it will not be found. You can send anything you want in that way. So he's basically telling his cousin in St. Louis, send me clothing, shoes, and sort of knit in or sew in a message somewhere within the fabric. And when I get it, I know where to look for it. So this is how they're smuggling letters into the camps. You can't send a letter in, a long letter in, but if you smuggle it in a shoe or a piece of clothing or hat, I can get it. Resistance and determination sometimes took a more open form. On one envelope sent to his aunt, a Confederate prisoner scribbled next to the Confederate stamp showing Jefferson Davis. Here is our good president. So remember, this is a Confederate POW in a Union prison. He's sending out a letter with a stamp of Jefferson Davis, which is, you know, the mail used in Confederacy. And he puts down next to it, I should have taken a photo of it when I had the chance, but there it is. He writes on the envelope, front of the envelope itself, next to Jefferson Davis, here is our good president. He's not given up. There was another case where, and in this case, this soldier sent out this particular letter in early March 1865. Both the Confederate presidency and the Confederacy itself fell just 1 month later. It's pretty incredible to think that just weeks out from the Confederate surrender, when Jefferson Davis had to flee Richmond and Richmond fell to Union forces, this one Confederate POW is still holding on in prison. He probably doesn't know what's going on fully at the front lines, but he's still insistent. Here is our president, not Lincoln, it's Jefferson Davis. The passage of the 13th Amendment later that year, 1865, followed by the 14th and 15th Amendments in subsequent years, completed the political dimension of the revolution that began with Fort Sumter. The Civil War was truly America's second revolution. The war transformed the social, political, economic, and even physical landscape of America. And just look at Richmond. It looks like a bombed-out city from World War II. This is Richmond soon after its surrender. The war's most fundamental and significant outcome was, of course, the destruction of legalized slavery and the elevation of some one-eighth of the American population from the status of property to the status of full citizens, at least on paper. Yet one revolutionary aspect of the war deserves more notice. The Civil War was a landmark in the histories of communication, of literacy, and of privacy. These concepts, the right to be heard, the right to be literate, the right to private space, are intimately connected to the notions of equality, human rights, and individual autonomy that lay at the heart of the war and of the American experience itself. In 1864, Confederate POW George B. Clark described to his correspondent in St. Louis the rules regarding the letters he sent to them. And these are his words. We have the privilege, as prisoners of war, of sending out and receiving letters subject to the restrictions that they are not of more than one page in length and of a strictly private nature. The two words I want to emphasize there are privilege and private. Perhaps without being aware of it, Clark gave a straightforward description of his epistolary life. In prison, that speaks to how privilege and privacy lay at the heart of both letter writing and the Civil War. Slavery denied the enslaved the fundamentals of human dignity, the right to read, to write, to be heard, to correspond, to have privacy. For white men, and for white men only, the words prison pen had two meanings. It meant an enclosure designed to prevent their freedom of movement. It also meant a writing instrument by which they could continue to exercise their agency, assert their voice through the postal mail, and even defy prison authorities. Put another way, imprisonment for white soldiers did not equate to the loss of their status as autonomous free men, immune to enslavement and entitled to write and to learn to write. For black Union soldiers captured by the Confederates, no such immunity or privilege existed. One Union POW during his stay at Charleston Prison recounted what happened to black Union soldiers captured during the Fairwood assault on Fort Wagner. Quote, soon after their capture, they were informed that they were to be tried by a civil commission on a charge of having abandoned their masters and enlisted in the United States Army, and if found guilty, they were told they might make up their minds to stretch hemp. To stretch hemp is hemp rope. It was relatively inelastic, and it made a good rope for hanging people. He said, these black Union soldiers are going to be hanged on the charge of disobeying their masters. A prison pen, should these black soldiers even be lucky enough to not be shot after surrendering, meant at least a reduction to the status of human property. At worst, it meant a show trial on the capital charge of participating in a slave insurrection. In simple terms, the Confederacy saw black POWs neither as honorable men nor as professional soldiers. Thus, both the act of letter writing, of acquiring literacy and accessing the postal mail, and the consequences of being a POW reflected the racial hierarchy and inequities in 19th century American life. Thank you.
Okay, I apologize in advance for not speaking about the Civil War. But in his study of the American POW narrative, Robert C. Doyle observed that, quote, surrender implies losing, and Americans in particular dislike losers, regardless of the context, end quote. Doyle recognized that surrendering was the worst possible fate for a combatant, as it challenged his personal honor and represented battlefield failure. Although Doyle's work was published more than 20 years ago, it offered a glimpse into the future of captivity studies. Scholars have recently made the dishonor and shame of surrender a central point of inquiry when exploring the prisoners of the First World War. Studies of German, Austro-Hungarian, British, and French prisoners have demonstrated that the desire to recover one's sense of honor played a significant role in how prisoners conducted themselves behind barbed wire. American prisoners of the First World War, however, have remained largely unexamined in this regard. An analysis of American attitudes towards surrender in the First World War offers an advantageous opportunity for comparison. The American POW experience was distinctive, yet the existence of widespread beliefs about soldierly virtue and manhood impacted the perception of prisoners from all belligerents. This paper will consider how idealized gender norms related to soldierly virtue shaped the American POW experience. In doing so, it aims to shed light on the larger topics of combat motivation and military culture in the First World War. For most American prisoners, captivity was different than it had been for combatants of other armies who surrendered before German troops captured the first doughboys in November of 1917. A small number of Americans became prisoners while serving under foreign flags before 1917, but by the time American servicemen entered enemy hands, captivity had become a mass phenomenon. German forces, for example, captured more than 1 million prisoners in the first year of combat. In camps around the globe, nearly 9 million prisoners from all sides had spent time in captivity by the end of the war. Of that number, less than 4,000 were American military personnel. Americans constituted a trivial percentage of the captives taken during the First World War, but they entered a camp system with which American authorities were extraordinarily familiar. American representatives, including Ambassador James W. Girard, began visiting German camps shortly after the outbreak of war. By spring 1915, American diplomats regularly inspected camps throughout Germany. Additionally, the American YMCA's prisoner relief work provided access to German camps and the opportunity to speak freely with prisoners. Schemes for neutral camp inspections, parcel and delivery posts, and the development of camp cultural activities were in place long before the first American prisoners arrived in Germany. Food shortages and overcrowded camps represented significant threats, but Americans generally had access to food from the home front and were captured after many of the kinks had been worked out of the prisoner care system. As former prisoner Mike Shallon recalled, quote, "We wouldn't even eat the regular rations the Germans gave us. We didn't need them," end quote. None of this, however, lessened the sensations of inadequacy that accompanied capture. Numerous masculine models coexist in every society, but militant masculinity has proven to be enduring. Societies around the globe fulfill their need for potential soldiers by closely linking the qualities of an efficient combatant, such as bravery, courage, and sacrificial nationalism, to idealized models of popular masculinity. Many cultures viewed war as a test of manhood. Scholars of surrender and captivity within European armies have argued that in the First World War, the ordeal was emasculating, as it suggested that prisoners had failed that test. Surrender removed prisoners from the proving ground, and prisoners could be accused of cowardice or disloyalty. Many suffered psychologically on account of the belief that they had let their fellow soldiers and themselves down. The need for redemption shaped their captive lives as resistors who were eager to rejoin the fight. Like their European counterparts, American soldiers matured in a society that associated manhood with soldierly virtue. At the turn of the 20th century, leaders argued that war offered the chance for men to, quote, prove their manly fighting virtues. These impressions influenced the American decision to risk war with Spain in 1898. For Jingoes, who recognized this link, the war with Spain represented an opportunity for, quote, character building that would produce veterans with the grit necessary to lead the United States into the next century. The youth who served in the First World War grew up during the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt, the Rough Rider who praised the lessons of combat and its ability to measure manhood. After listening to Civil War veterans describe their exploits, many men sought to prove themselves as equals to their elders. Despite news coverage that detailed the carnage of the Western Front, stories of Civil War grandeur and readings of the Red Badge of Courage played a significant role in shaping American perceptions of battle or what they thought battle was going to be like. When the United States declared war in spring 1917, it called upon a diverse population of conscripts, including immigrants who were new to the country. The relationship between manhood and one's ability to fight, though, was nearly universal. Conscripts and volunteers thus understood the demands of wearing a military uniform. And as Richard S. Faulkner has argued, quote, "the desire to live up to the expectations of manliness was a powerful inducement to serve," end quote. Some Americans were so eager to fight in Europe that they enlisted with foreign armies before spring 1917. Their attitudes toward captivity provided a preview of American responses to surrender. James J. Bach joined the Foreign Legion in August 1914 before becoming an aviator in French service. In September 1915, he crashed behind the German lines and spent more than 3 years in captivity. The post-war history of the Lafayette Flying Corps claimed that he had, quote, "the distinction, a doubtful one in his opinion, of being the first American taken prisoner." The Corps history referred to Bach as the director of the Amerikanische Kriegsgefangenenklub, or American Prisoner of War Club, but stressed that he was not to blame, as he had attempted to escape on several occasions. Bach's biographical sketch includes several justifications for his surrender and reveals that he was quite uncomfortable with his status as the first American prisoner. At other times, the editors mention Bach's unsought-for distinction, suggesting once again that his captivity remained a source of embarrassment. Another pilot, Lieutenant Pat O'Brien, left the American Flying Corps for the Royal Flying Corps in 1916. In August 1917, he was shot down and captured by the Germans, and although he survived his fall to the earth, he was, quote, never so depressed in his life as when he awoke from unconsciousness and realized that he was a prisoner of war. O'Brien was determined to escape and leapt from a train while being transferred to the German interior. He arrived in the Netherlands after 2 months on the run and eventually made his way to London, where he gained an audience with the king. When asked what he planned to do with his newfound freedom, O'Brien replied that he would, quote, rejoin his squadron at the earliest possible moment. The king, however, insisted that O'Brien had done enough. The lieutenant returned to the United States and published his memoir, Outwitting the Hun. It propelled O'Brien to celebrity standing and made him one of the most desired speakers in the country. And you see a flyer for one of those speeches there. Whereas prisoners had been viewed as losers, O'Brien demonstrated that escape allowed them to reclaim their status as combatants along with the respect afforded to brave warriors. The most enlightening testimonial of any American that surrendered in the service of a foreign power was that of Harold Willis, an ambulance driver who joined the Escadrille Lafayette in 1916. Willis was shot down in August 1917, and in his initial letter from captivity, he lamented that he was the first member of the escadrille to be taken alive, a designation he referred to as, quote, a dubious distinction. He recounted the extensive damage to his plane in great detail, as if to emphasize the effort required to bring him down. Willis claimed that as his plane hurtled toward the earth, he, quote, had an awful feeling of despair at the thought of the inevitable landing in Germany and had an instant desire to dive into the ground. He confessed to, quote, having cried like a baby when placed in his cell. Willis initially regretted that he had survived and felt like a, quote, sort of living corpse. He longed to be at the front where he believed every man was needed. Willis succeeded in escaping from the prison camp at Villingen in Baden and crossed into Switzerland in October 1918. His redemption through escape enabled him to speak openly about the indignity of surrender and captivity. His correspondence reveals that he considered a suicidal death before landing in enemy territory, which suggests that death in a blaze of glory had temporarily seemed preferable to surrender. The experiences of these three Americans show that becoming a prisoner of war was a dubious distinction. Captivity contradicted the narrative of sacrificial heroism, and the pilots who entered German captivity before the United States' arrival in Europe had let themselves down. Bach, O'Brien, and Willis each attempted escape, and their efforts confirmed their recognition that a prisoner's duty was to return to the front. Even before the publication of Outwitting the Hun, the American press covered O'Brien's exploits, and the attention granted to his successful flight verified that redemption was achievable for men who proved ready to risk their lives fleeing from their captors. The American doughboys that arrived in Europe in 1917 were no less willing to fight than the volunteers who had come before them. Their first days in uniform were characterized by both anticipation and fear that they might not be up to the task ahead of them. According to a YMCA representative, the European allies needed proof that doughboys were not, quote, tin soldiers, and Americans were keen to exhibit their resolve. Their eagerness to fight sometimes led to carelessness, and they took heavy casualties due to their lack of caution and experience. As Americans moved into the trenches in large numbers, the possibility of capture increased. The soldier commonly identified as the first doughboy prisoner to fall into German hands did so in November of 1917. Sergeant Edgar M. Halliburton had joined the regular army in 1909 and was a career soldier. During an artillery barrage, Halliburton reportedly lost both his weapons and was reaching for an axe to defend himself when he was knocked unconscious. When he awoke, Halliburton fought his German captors as they pulled him across no man's land. Realizing that, quote, nothing was likely to spare him the ignominy of being the first American soldier to pass through the German lines as a prisoner, Halliburton attempted suicide by leaping towards an exploding shell, according to his narrative. He survived, though, and was literally dragged into captivity by his captors. The Germans sought to use American prisoners for propaganda and arranged to photograph the first captured doughboys. Halliburton faced his captors with a stiff jaw and clenched fist, refusing to appear intimidated. The capture of the first Americans was front page news in the United States. Neutrals later shared the photographs of Halliburton and his men, and before anyone knew the defiant prisoner's name, he was being praised as the symbol of the American fighting spirit. And there is a second photograph, and you can see him here once again staring down towards the ground, not even wanting to look at the photographer. Halliburton's boldness inspired Boston sculptor Cyrus Dallin to create a statuette titled Captured But Not Conquered in Halliburton's likeness. It became the centerpiece of the advertising campaign for the Fourth Liberty Loan. Across the country, libraries and museums displayed the statuette, and the public reception was overwhelmingly positive. The Gillette Blade featured the sculpture on its cover and asserted that, quote, the fine, manly figure breathing defiance to the hellish Hun would stir the emotions of all true Americans, end quote. The Bulletin of the New Hampshire Public Libraries claimed that Halliburton's likeness typified, quote, the manhood of America and impressed upon one the indomitable spirit of the American soldier. In captivity, Halliburton maintained his defiant attitude and insisted that his men do the same. When Germans transferred him to the Rastatt prison camp, he found that the American prisoners there had let themselves go. He immediately took charge. Some of the men at Rastatt, according to Halliburton's estimation, had, quote, let the Germans capture them because they were too yellow to fight. So he was very critical of other prisoners of war. He earned the men's respect, instituted military discipline, and resisted German efforts to distribute pro-German propaganda in the camp. Halliburton cultivated American nationalism behind barbed wire and encouraged the men to face their enemies with heads held high. When the Germans distributed a camp newspaper called America and Europe, Halliburton forbade the reading of the paper and was sent to a punishment camp as a result. He returned after YMCA protests, and his work at Rastatt was admired by the organization's representatives, who praised Halliburton as the maintainer of discipline and morale among American prisoners of war. Halliburton spent the remainder of the war in Germany. He returned home a minor celebrity and received the Distinguished Service Medal for his leadership. He learned of the statue captured but not conquered only after his repatriation to the United States, as the sculptor Dallin had sent a casting to Halliburton's mother in North Carolina. The former prisoner struggled with peacetime life and grew tired of speaking of his experiences. In his 1932 memoir, he claimed that following repatriation, he had been on the verge of a nervous breakdown and felt that he could not escape the, quote, chiseled image of Dallin's statue, which he believed watched him as he slept. Halliburton drank heavily and was frequently arrested. He changed his name, but he could not escape his past, ultimately insisting that in reality, he had been both captured and conquered. Halliburton may have been disappointed in himself, but his experiences suggest that Americans found it acceptable to be taken prisoner so long as one fought valiantly and remained defiant in captivity. Halliburton sought to distinguish himself from those prisoners whom he believed to be yellow. His fearlessness when surrounded by the enemy identified him as a soldier who refused to back down or submit. Halliburton feared the ignominy of being the first American prisoner, but his refusal to be conquered made him a model of wartime manhood. Halliburton had proven his mettle behind barbed wire, but others saw escape as the preferable road to redemption. The first doughboy to escape the Germans was Frank Sawicki, a Polish immigrant who joined the army in April of 1917. While serving as a company liaison, Sawicki was cut off from his company and captured. The Germans sent him to Rastatt and assigned him to agricultural labor outside of the camp. One evening after work, he managed to lock his guard in the guardhouse and make his escape. Using the Swiss Alps as his guide, Sawicki headed for the Swiss border and actually pole vaulted across the river separating Germany and Switzerland. He did not receive the attention afforded to many of the earlier prisoners discussed, and his name does not appear on any commendation lists. Nonetheless, as Stars and Stripes reported, he emerged from that stream separating Germany and Switzerland not as Frank Sawicki the Russian Pole, but Frank Sawicki the American. War had provided the immigrant Sawicki with the opportunity to prove his commitment and merit as a fighting man. Stars and Stripes commentary suggests that he had entered captivity as a Pole, having not yet earned his American manhood. If frontline service had not confirmed his mettle, his daring escape confirmed his worth as a man and soldier. Sawicki left behind no memoir and virtually disappeared after his return to the United States. Another prisoner, Norman Archibald, left a detailed account of his feelings about captivity. Archibald volunteered for the aviation section of the Signal Corps in 1917. Shot down in September of 1918, Archibald later recalled, the realization that he had surrendered made him, quote, sick. He was immediately filled with regret and asked himself, quote, why did I stand there like an ass and let them take me? Archibald thought of flights against the enemy he would never take and pleaded, quote, God Almighty, why did this happen to me? In the German camps, Archibald and his fellow prisoners dreamt of escape, not only for the sake of freedom, but as a fellow pilot argued, for one more chance at the Huns. Being removed from battle meant that prisoners lost the opportunity to contribute to the war to prove themselves. Escapes were often, therefore, described as an attempt to return to the front. Edward Isaacs, who became a prisoner after the sinking of the USS President Lincoln, likewise believed that he was a valuable asset to the war effort and sought escape in order to rejoin the Navy. Following his successful escape to Switzerland in October of 1918, Isaacs lamented that he was not able to make it back to active duty before war's end. He ended his memoir with the words, I was too late. Nonetheless, Isaacs was rewarded for his efforts with a Congressional Medal of Honor. It is impossible to draw firm conclusions based on the limited examples of American prisoners discussed today. But in this initial foray into the links between gender norms and attitudes about surrender, it becomes evident that American attitudes toward surrender were not exceptional. Many Americans saw battle as a test of manhood, and surrender forced observers and combatants alike to regard prisoners as something other than conquerors. The fear of being taken prisoner motivated soldiers to fight when the tables turned against them. Any discussion of combat motivation should include the desire to maintain one's soldierly honor and sense of manhood. The prisoners examined today described their captivity as disheartening, quote, an undreamed of predicament, and it hovered like a cloud over their heads. In some cases, they considered suicide rather than submit to the enemy. Like European prisoners, they struggled with their distance from the battlefield and suffered as a result of their wounded pride and masculinity. American prisoners also shared their European counterparts' belief in the necessity of escaping whenever possible. Returning to the front meant returning to the proving ground, and prisoners who longed for another opportunity embraced the dangers associated with flight. Even unsuccessful escape attempts provided prisoners with proof of their desire to fight. When escape was not possible, prisoners could earn their countrymen's respect by remaining defiantly captured but not conquered, as was the case with Halliburton. Surrender did not represent an unforgivable sin or mark against one's masculine honor, but it required a redoubling of one's efforts to display the American fighting spirit. My arguments today have been based on records left by escapers and those whose defiance was quite literally memorialized in bronze. But what of the more than 3,000 American prisoners who did not escape Germany and left behind no published records of their experiences? Their accounts of and reactions to captivity exist in family letters, unpublished memoirs, military reports, and camp inspection reports. Uncovering their stories and beginning to comprehend more fully their experiences will require extensive archival research. The limited interest in American prisoners of war up to this point may be related to Robert C. Doyle's contention that Americans, quote, dislike losers regardless of the context. Although that may be the case, it is my hope that this preliminary research has suggested that Americans may have indeed disliked losers, but they also love a comeback. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. My name is Adam Rock, and I'm going to be continuing our linear progression of POWs in history here. I don't have a PowerPoint, so I apologize. You'll have to use your imaginations. So let's get here. Throughout the war, Americans continued to question the civility and benevolence of a territorial, aggressive, and racially other enemy, directly challenging the United States. While historians have previously examined this ambivalent relationship, the general focus remains on combat motivations, subsequently overlooking the perceptions of average Americans and influential politicians and a large number of stateside military personnel serving outside the combat zone. How did the large majority of Americans view Japanese forces during the war, and in what ways, if any, did these perceptions change by September of 1945? While historians thoroughly document the experience of German and Italian prisoners in the U.S., their story of the Japanese counterparts remains relatively unexplored. My study investigates how race influenced the treatment and re-education of nearly 5,000 Japanese POWs held in the United States during World War II. While in theory, American policy made no distinction between the racially different groups of prisoners, discrepancies become apparent when carrying out these vague directives. Although the Geneva Convention of 1929 specifically forbade attempts to indoctrinate POWs, it also required captors to provide and encourage enemy prisoners with intellectual pursuits. Through the vaguely written articles regulating intellectual pursuits and leisure, American personnel eventually introduced a clandestine program aimed at indoctrinating a large numbers of German and Japanese POWs held in the United States. While Americans initially expressed noticeable reservations about the willingness of German prisoners to actively participate in organized re-education programs, they generally believed that any similar efforts to indoctrinate Japanese POWs would be completely unrealistic due to their fanatical loyalty and perceived communalistic nature. Evidence also shows how American commanders clearly ignored reports countering the perceived notion that Japanese POWs were incorrigible and impossible to re-educate. Despite having additional time to prepare and previous experience with educating German prisoners, their Japanese program drastically lagged behind in both available educational materials and qualified personnel. Although several other potential factors may have led to these inconsistencies, racism seems the most significant factor behind the glaring variations in the War Department's re-education program. Fueled by racially expressed propaganda, Fueled by explicitly propaganda, Americans became preoccupied with the image of the menacing Japanese ape-like invaders, while others respected and revered their adversary humanized through pre-war newsreels or personal interaction with POWs in the United States. Highlighting these conflicting images will also offer a more comprehensive view into the American perceptions of the Japanese during the war, while uncovering the effectiveness of domestic propaganda in continually influencing those views. With most of the basic problems regarding the treatment and employment of nearly 340,000 enemy prisoners of war in the United States largely solved by the fall of 1944, most American personnel appeared generally content with POW operations, although a few of these officials feared releasing nearly 500,000 pro-fascist foot soldiers back to war-torn areas without some sort of political re-education once the war had ended. The Geneva Convention specifically forbade attempts to indoctrinate prisoners of war, but also required captors to provide and encourage enemy POWs with intellectual pursuits. American personnel would eventually use this stipulation to introduce their clandestine program. Examining the American re-education program and how it varied in content and implication between German and Japanese POWs provides an opportunity to observe American perceptions of the Japanese and highlight the influence of racism in the treatment of those POWs. In addition to outlining housing, diet, recreational activities, and labor requirements for prisoners of war, the convention also required signatory nations to provide POWs with educational materials that encouraged their intellectual pursuits. While the provisions outlined in Article 17 intended to provide prisoners with access to newspapers, books, newsreel, classroom instruction, and other forms of intellectual diversion, its vaguely wording ultimately gave captors the power to decide what materials was appropriate and how it would disseminate among the POWs. Under the pretenses of providing the required intellectual diversion, the War Department began developing its clandestine re-education program in March of 1943. When the first large groups of POWs began arriving in the United States. The American public held vastly different views when the topic of re-education and enemy POWs first surfaced. Some seemed supportive and hoped to successfully rehabilitate German and Japanese prisoners. Others rejected that idea on grounds that the task was impossible. A 1946 Gallup poll highlighted the wide range of American perceptions, including the mildly optimistic, quote, "the Japanese should be educated in our ways of living. After about 100 years, they might be ready to assume some responsibility and find right-thinking people in Japan, work with them, and training others to live right," end quote. These statements highlight the conflicting desire to educate POWs on the workings of American democracy and a belief that doing so was a very real possibility. However, another commentator in the same poll argued Americans should, quote, annihilate the whole Japanese race, get rid of every last one, women and children too, end quote, rejecting that any notion of reeducation was worthwhile. Ultimately, several leading academics, journalists, politicians, military officials weighed in on this issue and were clearly divided on the idea of indoctrination. Although many believed the program could have some significant influence among the Germans, most Americans were less optimistic about the possibility of including the several thousand Japanese prisoners in the program. Overall, several factors appear to contribute to the American perception that Japanese prisoners could not be reeducated, including pre-war racial stereotypes, the brutal nature of the Pacific War, as well as the fanatical sense of collective identity and devotion to the emperor among Japanese soldiers. While the general consensus appeared in favor of excluding Japanese POWs from the formal re-education program, the feeling was not unanimous. Although officials initially excluded Japanese prisoners from indoctrination efforts within the United States, they had already become underway in areas outside the United States, including the China-Burma Indian Theater. John Emerson, a State Department officer assigned to the CBI Theater during the war, noted that a large amount of valuable information provided by the Japanese forces captured in Burma. Emerson wrote, quote, "There seems to be no feeling that he is a traitor to his country, but rather he no longer belongs to a country," end quote. The reasoning behind this statement ties back to the psychological makeup of Japanese troops who believed they could never return home after suffering the immense shame of surrender. Japanese POWs in captivity seem to embrace the principles of a spiritual rebirth contained in their Buddhist religious beliefs. And despite being in the clear minority, those members saw the potential for including Japanese into the re-education program. American officials like John Emerson were not alone. Although official regulations did not sanction indoctrination efforts, prior to the fall of 1944, several camp commanders experienced with unofficial result, including Otis Carey, an assistant POW camp commander located near Pearl Harbor. Unfortunately, Carey's represents a minority within the American military who shared a much more optimistic view of Japanese people. Having grown up in Japan to a longtime missionary parents and spending considerable portions of his formative years in and around Japanese, learning the way of life. Through Carey's hands-on encouragement, a small group of Japanese POWs worked in conjunction with civilian educators and utilized Japanese language texts from local Nisei community and the University of Hawaii at Honolulu in order to begin the official democratization program, later known as the Hawaiian College. Without official orders, this influential group of Japanese prisoners began reading and translating material that might help to democratize post-war Japan. Under Carey's guidance, Japanese POWs taught their fellow prisoners classes in English language, history, and politics, with each lecture identifying the ways Japan would need to adapt into the post-war world. After lecture, prisoners engage in a wide-ranging variety of discussions and the idea presented within each topic. In addition to the classroom instruction, lecture, and assigned readings, Japanese POWs in Hawaii published a pro-democratic Japanese language newspaper that was largely seen as unbiased as it came from the prisoners themselves. The willingness of American personnel to allow Japanese POWs to play an active role in creating this curriculum, translating material, and administering lectures greatly contributed to the initial success of the program in Hawaii, 1 year before similar efforts for Japanese POWs were in place stateside. Despite disregarding the results of Otis Carey's unofficial prisoner-led indoctrination effort at Pearl Harbor, orders were given to transfer a few selective instructors to help improve American propaganda directly related to the war effort. At Irakul Point, an island adjacent to Fort Island in Pearl Harbor, a group of about 30 Japanese prisoners monitored by Carey set to work improving Japanese propaganda being used in the Pacific. Unlike the majority of U.S. personnel clouded by ignorance or misguided by racial propaganda, Carey seemed determined to treat Japanese POWs not as enemies, but as human beings, individuals who deserved a bright future, adding to the reconstruction of a new democratic Japan. One of the first operations with the POWs at Irakul Point worked to improve the effectiveness of Mariana Hijo, a propaganda newspaper used to undermine the morale of Japanese troops in the front lines. Japanese POWs also working with the Psych Ops program helped to improve various other aspects of American propaganda, including translating the Potsdam Declaration for leaflets dropped to the popular Japanese people by B-29s over Japan. The use of Carey's POWs at Iroquois Point attests to the receptiveness of Japanese Americans, or the Japanese, to American re-education programs, as well as American willingness to violate the Geneva Convention. Both factors suggest that the motivating factor behind the differential education opportunities and re-education policies came down to race, as American officials were unwilling to blatantly violate the convention when it came to Japanese prisoners. They were willing to violate the convention in terms of Japanese prisoners, but not German. To implement the Army's official re-education program, the Provost Marshal General's office organized to oversee the project. A group of educators and sociologists became known as the Prisoners of War Special Projects Division. This mission stated it was a very clear program by the War Department not only to encourage intellectual pursuits of the prisoners, it was a deliberate indoctrination of German prisoners of war. The Special Projects Division immediately went to work looking for qualified American personnel who were fluent in German, held a college degree preferably in liberal arts, and displayed imagination as well as good judgment. Selecting books, films, educational materials that stressed Christian ethics and revealed the true history of German and American history, the Special Projects Division had hoped to dispel the Nazi charge that the United States was inefficient, decadent, and corrupt. The first camp used to test the experimental re-education program was at Fort Philip Kearny, Rhode Island, a former coastal artillery post in the middle of Narragansett Bay. The new facility at Fort Kearny would later be known as the factory. The staff at the factory composed of prisoners of war, Special Project Division officials, as well as 85 German prisoners considered to be ardent anti-Nazis. The original prisoners who participated in the development of the program consisted exclusively of German officers who volunteered for the assignment. The re-education program then broke down into six independent sections responsible for selecting the most effective pro-democratic material available in the field. The diverse team assembled at Fort Kearny eventually produced a template that all the prisoners of war camps would follow within the United States. The Special Projects Division selected opinionated and democratically based film, reading materials, and other documents. These included books banned in Germany and pamphlets promoting democratic values over national socialism, as well as publishing a nationally distributed anti-Nazi newspaper named Der Ruf, or The Call, sold in all POW camps across the country. Officials from the Special Projects Division also presented films focusing on the advances of American industry, construction, and infrastructure. These movies highlighted the vast untapped resources of American landscape and newsreels, showing the diverse population working together in the United States to create a more positive view while also entertaining German prisoners. To guarantee prisoners absorb the pro-democratic message, the Special Projects Division incorporated formal lectures and discussions into a re-education program. These ranged from classes on the English language to mathematics to soil conservation, American literature, and agricultural engineering. Prisoners were encouraged to participate in the discussion following the lectures by college faculty that frequently included local history. Academics and military personnel alike emphasized the melting pot nature of American life with its peaceful cooperation and different ethnical elements while constructing their lectures. Despite the initial success of re-educating Japanese POWs in Hawaii, the reports showing the Japanese at Camp McCoy in Wisconsin were just as responsible to indoctrination as German prisoners. The Provost Marshal General's office and the Army Service Forces remained convinced that the formal indoctrination program should only include German prisoners of war. Over the next year, and despite repeated requests from inquiry of civilian military personnel, the U.S. War Department made no effort to expand the program to include Japanese prisoners of war. The unauthorized Navy re-education program underway at Pearl Harbor should have given American officials much more evidence than needed to demonstrate the feasibility of re-educating Japanese POWs, especially as Japanese prisoners of war themselves constructed and implemented the program. In addition to the Japanese-based Hawaiian program, the Provost Marshal General's office had also other examples attesting to Japanese prisoners' receptiveness toward re-education efforts. In his report, Captain Traub showed a Japanese prisoners of war responded to fair treatment by American personnel at McCoy, positively and even appeared to enjoy themselves. He went on to explain, quote, the Japanese played baseball during recreation, plays gymnastics, and even put on a theatrical show to which the camp CO was invited from the American officers, end quote. By March of 44, examples like the prisoner-led program at Pearl Harbor, reports from other officers like Shepard Traub documented the continuous lobbying from civilians, academics, that eventually led the War Department and the Provost Marshal General's office to reconsider their decision to exclude Japanese prisoners of war from the re-educational program. When the Special Projects Division finally decided to include Japanese prisoners of war program, POWs in its official program, in the summer of 1945, officials immediately started segregating 5,000 Japanese. They started screening the 5,000 Japanese program or POWs in the United States, the American camps into a sort of in. I'm sorry. Let me rephrase that. Once they began, they sorted the 5,000 Japanese that were in the United States, and of those, they selected 200 of the most qualified prisoners of war and to initiate the re-education program in one of three camps located in Texas. By mid-June, the Japanese prisoners successfully relocated to camps Huntsville, Kennedy, or Herney in Texas and awaited further instruction. Although the War Department had been conducting its re-education program on German prisoners of war for over 9 months before the German or the Japanese program began to form classes in Texas, American officials failed to incorporate the most successful aspects of German prison or of the German prisoner of war program when creating the parallel Japanese program. The Special Projects Division utilized the cooperative German efforts to help construct the program, curriculum, and even lecture to fellow POWs. The content and specifics of the Japanese program were left strictly to American service personnel and selected academics at Sam Houston State Teachers College. The senior American official selected to supervise the Japanese re-education program was Lieutenant Colonel Bode C. Moore, an American born to missionary parents in Japan who received his education in the United States and returned to live in Japan 1924 to 1941. Assisting Colonel Boyd in outlining the Japanese re-education program, the Provost Marshal Generals assigned Dr. Charles E. Hepner, a well-known veteran of the Far Eastern Branch and Office of the War Department of Information, and a 30-year resident of Japan. These two men will construct a series of lectures on various topics ranging from studying the English language and American history to discussions comparing Japanese and American literature, books, and magazines. Unlike the instructors who had been carefully selected by the Special Projects Division and were fluent in German, instructors used in the Japanese program relied on prisoners to translate lectures to the class because they could not speak the language themselves. This language barrier also extended the Japanese to other aspects of the Japanese re-education program, such as shortages in textbooks, magazines, and other published material, as well as what films could be made available to the prisoners. Under the watchful eye of camp officials, Japanese POWs in Texas worked to translate written material that could be distributed to the remaining prisoners of war selected for re-education. Like German program, the Special Projects Division worked with the Japanese POWs to create a pro-democratic Japanese language newspaper that could be distributed to Japanese POWs nationwide. American officials also included Japanese POWs encouraged them to attend Christian religious services in an effort to break them from the, quote, traditional emperor worship. While camp personnel encouraged the religious transformation of Japanese POWs, this was not about conversion. Instead, these officials intended to lead prisoners away from their feelings of group mentality and intense nationalism. In addition to written material in religious services, the Special Projects Division made a detailed effort to utilize movies and newsreels in the indoctrination effort of Japanese prisoners of war. Native language officials. American personnel believed the use of movies in re-education program would help, quote, disassociate the individual from the state and establish the right of the individual to follow his desires with the scope of American accepted social customs, end quote, as well as, quote, impress the Japanese with the solidarity of their opposition, a solidarity that exists not only in military strength, but also in fundamental laws of decency and living, end quote. In addition to classroom lectures and reading materials and movies and Japanese films, Japanese prisoners filled their time with recreational activities including table tennis, baseball, American music, and even popular cartoons. Before the Japanese program had a real chance to test itself, unfortunately, the War Department decided that after a surrender, unlike a majority of the German prisoners of war, who would remain for almost a year to continue the re-education program and labor, Japanese POWs were to be repatriated home as soon as possible. Despite the results of the Japanese program, it appeared American officials remained convinced that only German POWs were worth indoctrinating. While Japanese prisoners of war had been rapidly deployed home upon VJ Day, eliminating further opportunities for re-education, the German effort was expanded in order to attempt to expose more prisoners prior to repatriation. Unfortunately, whatever good the former 200 students of the Army's re-education program could have done upon repatriation will likely never be known, as they arrived home after a military occupation under General Douglas MacArthur had been established and were excluded by the conservative post-war government. In January 1946, the remaining POWs in the United States boarded ships in San Francisco Bay, headed for the... headed for the home, and unfortunately, detailed system questionnaires that was given to German POWs who participated in the re-education program, this was not extended to Japanese prisoners of war. In conclusion, American treatment of enemy POWs varied in both content and application depending on the race of each prisoner. Despite having additional time to prepare and over 9 months' previous experience with re-educating German prisoners, the Japanese program lagged behind in both available educational materials and qualified personnel. American policymakers also ignored numerous reports that Japanese POWs responded well to these programs, although several other potential factors may have led to these inconsistencies, including public opinion, language barriers, and shortage in qualified instructors. Throughout the program's eventual evolution, applying racial stereotypes, available work assignments, and access to these lagged considerably behind the comparable German program. A closer examination has shown considerable evidence existed and validated these claims that was ignored or overlooked by American policymakers. Acknowledging that racism was perhaps the most influential factor of the Pacific War, we have seen the American treatment of Japanese POWs provides no exception. While Japanese prisoners extended the treatment that often varied in completion or in comparison to German prisoners of war also held in the United States, their captivity remains immeasurably better than conditions shown by American prisoners of war by the Japanese. The widely publicized stories of Japanese atrocities also contributed to the anti-Japanese American sentiment during the war and further tarnished the American perception of the Japanese military. Although most Americans had almost no previous exposure to the Japanese before the war, they found themselves searching for Pearl Harbor on a map shortly after news of the surprise attack reached thousands of American homes. An eager public enthusiastically consumed an endless stream of racist propaganda designed to vilify and dehumanize the Japanese people. While it appears that the personal interaction often worked to reverse preconceived notions of Japanese, the relatively small number of Japanese POWs in the United States, combined with orders to keep these men away from the general public, ultimately limited the opportunity to establish the type of personal relationships needed to overcome propaganda. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, everybody. So I'm trying to keep us some time, so but we still have about 10 minutes for questions. Yes, sir.
Where is the sculpture of the Confederate soldier from North Carolina that you talk about?
The doughboy from the First World War. The original, there was one original bronze done, and it was sent to a library somewhere, and I believe in New Hampshire, and I think it's still there. And then there were castings that were sent all around the country, smaller statuettes. I have an eBay problem, and so I immediately started looking for one of these. I found one, and it cost about $3,500, which is too rich for my blood right now. But I think there are hundreds of them out there.
Yes, ma'am.
So my disclaimer, I'm a historian of modern Germany, and I just wrote this paper for this conference. So I don't know that much about American prisoners of war, but I know I have seen those figures, that there of among the Americans taken prisoner, there were some that were taken prisoner in Russia, because I think there was an American group that went to Archangel, and so some of those soldiers were taken prisoner.
Do you have any idea what the number was?
I don't know the number.
Lorraine?
I have a question for Brian and then
I think there is probably a difference. And just the little I've done looking at the German Revolution of 1918, it seems like civil wars tend to be a little more brutal because there's a sense of betrayal that your brother has stabbed you in the back, and there's this kind of almost hate that you don't tend to see when it's not a civil war. And so I don't know that you know, I don't have a whole lot to offer in terms of insight, but my inkling is that civil wars are probably worse.
Yeah, I would definitely concur with that. I think you have much more infighting, I think, as well. It's regarding to domestic, and I think you have cultural aspects too. As far as the Japanese and Germans, Germans were much more. Not only were they aware that they could surrender. Japanese, it wasn't discussed among the Japanese at all. So you know, you have that cultural, you know, discrepancy to initiate in the process. So I think when you deal domestically, you have. You're able to absolve yourself of the outside cultural influences.
And I actually had a very different set of questions.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
For you, Adam. That's okay. So there's a bunch of them, and I think some of them are just things to think about that your audience might be curious as you're expanding your work. But I was very curious about the content of the detailed questionnaires that were given to the German prisoners that you referenced in your paper. What were the types of questions that they were asked and what their responses were? And I wondered if it would be possible to assess the effectiveness of the indoctrination of the German POWs. And then kind of on a related note to the Japanese prisoners, how much is in the records about these Japanese prisoners who led the Hawaii program? They seem to have embraced efforts to change their culture. Do we have any clues about their motivations to collaborate with their captors? Is there any information about their lives in Japan after the war? I mean, is it possible to get at these prisoners?
And that's partially my fault as well. But I mean, that's a great question. Thank you so much. I think the questionnaires themselves with the Germans dealt with they were specifically implemented to try to gauge the effectiveness of the re-education program. And I think it was you can see the comparisons between the initial questionnaires and the post-war questionnaires. And generally, they were how do you feel about. It was vaguely written, but it was National Socialism as opposed to democracy, and to kind of see how they stick to the wall when they threw the stuff at them. Unfortunately, the Japanese prisoners of war didn't have a similar thing, you know, so we can't really gauge it. And then the few that were re-educated in America were almost an elite, because the ones, we had about 5,000 in the United States, and there were several thousand that were captured in Australia. But the ones that were transported to the United States were deemed of intelligence necessary, although that was never explained what so, and like a lot of the interrogations with these prisoners of war was minute. So you see, I think with Otis Carey's, the main difference with that, I think they were officers. They were naval officers, and they were much more receptive to the treatment of Carey, the positive treatment of Carey and his cultural assemblance with them, so they're able to kind of feel a camaraderie, and then to use that to expand it. I think it's just that it goes to the kind of rebirth. I think the Japanese would feel that their one life has ended, and this is the beginning of a new life. So I think that deals with it.
Thank you. Last question, yeah.
Sorry,
I think that would more go to what Adam, I think.
Uh-huh. No, I'm a little difficult to hear, and I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear the whole question.
The lady was asking, there's a comparison or a more successful re-education program after the war under U.S. occupation in Japan versus what is happening during the war.
Well, that's a great question. I think it's... unfortunately, the occupations were very different in Europe and Japan. We have almost a complete military occupation in Japan, so you see a very reluctant of the United States military to incorporate Japanese civilians in that. It's much more top-down, as opposed to the German program. They initially determined they weren't going to do a full military occupation of Japan, so these were going to be their foot soldiers. They were going to use them to re-educate them and democratic ideas to kind of like put them and teach their fellow Germans, as opposed to, I think, the post-war mentality where they knew they were going to do a re-education or a complete occupation of Japan, so these gentlemen weren't necessary. I think I would really like to look into how they affected their culture, how they affected, there's several, civilizations or neighbors, but it's difficult due to language barriers, and as well as it's not a very popular, these men wouldn't want to actually acknowledge that they did surrender and become POWs because it was still culturally a shame upon them back home.
All right, one more question then. So it's a question about the experience of immigrants here in the United States. You had, on the one hand, a lot of German immigrants, and on the other hand, you had Japanese immigrants in the Western state. And if there's a cultural difference, mm-hmm. that also teach you something about the re-education program.
Absolutely, yeah, I think so. I think it's and that you see the cultural ineptitude of the United States in the 40s. It's very black and white, and it's almost it's like these are. They're wrong and we're right, and we're going to teach them. So, I mean, you see, it's the cultural influence was on individuals rather than a program down, so unfortunately.
Can you speak up a little bit, sir?
I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, everybody. We can continue the conversation over coffee break, so we're going to be back at 2:45, okay?